Good afternoon. My name is Patrick, and I will be your conference operator today. At this time, I would like to welcome everyone to the Economic Cost of Healthcare Reform Uphill Conference Call. All lines have been placed on mute to prevent any background noise. After the speaker's remarks, there will be a question and answer session. If you'd like to ask a question during this time, simply press star, then the number 1 on your telephone keypad. If you'd like to withdraw your question, press the pound key. Thank you. Ms. Tandon, you may begin the conference.
Thank you all very much. I want to welcome you all to this call where we will be discussing the economic impact of repeal of the health care law. I am honored to be joined by Congresswoman Rosa DeLauro. She is the leader. She is a congresswoman from Connecticut's 3rd District. She's also co-chair of the House Steering and Policy Committee and chairs the Appropriations Agriculture Subcommittee. She's also a cancer survivor herself and was a tremendous advocate on behalf of the law and making the law, ensuring that the law was as protective of quality, affordable health care as possible. And we are also honored to be joined by David Cutler, who is the author of our new report. He is a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress and has authored a new report discussing the economic impact of the health care law and outlines how repealing the law will destroy 250 to 400,000 jobs annually. And we feel this report is so critical because of the real distortions and just wrongful information that's been put out about the legislation itself and what repeal will mean. And with that, I would like to introduce David Cutler.
Thank you very much, Neera, and good morning or good midday to everybody. I will not summarize the entire report in detail because you have it, but let me just make 3 points that come up in the report that give you what the economics community has to say about the economic impacts of repealing healthcare. So the first point is that rising healthcare costs harm the economy. And this is kind of without debate. That is, there's no one who really believes otherwise. The evidence is very clear. If you look at employment effects, every 10% increase in cost growth above GDP growth translates into about 120,000 jobs lost. There are several studies that point that direction. In addition, there are workers who can't move from one job to another because they're afraid of losing their health insurance or afraid to retire and take care of a sick relative or move part-time and take care of a sick relative because they're afraid they will be priced out of insurance or dropped or unable to afford care. So all of that's very clear. There's decades of research on it. The second point is that the healthcare reform, when it comes to the cost containment and system modernization end, is really actually quite state-of-the-art. It deals with all of the major areas in which the economics and policy community believes there's money to be saved. One is in prevention, and it stresses prevention quite a lot, provides enormous incentives for it and funding for it, thanks, as Neera said, in great effort to the Congresswoman. Second, it deals with administrative streamlining, which is probably 100 times more costly in healthcare than in other industries and accounts for in total 10 to 15% of healthcare costs. It makes enormous progress there. And third, it has a fundamental transformation of the way that physicians are paid, the way that hospitals are paid, the way that the system is organized to promote better care, more effective care. We know that these models work. There are published studies in the New England Journal of Medicine, in JAMA, in health affairs, in academic settings. There was just a study that came out yesterday supporting this. It's the same theory that underlies what the Dartmouth folks say, what the folks at Mark McClellan's group at Brookings say, what the folks at AEI say, what the Business Roundtable says. So there's actually quite a deal of convergence around that. That's all in the Affordable Care Act. So therefore, what this study really does is it takes those two pieces together and says, what would be the impact of repealing them? So if you take the job loss estimates that come from higher health care costs and the estimates that come from all over the place on what would be the impact of repealing the Affordable Care Act on costs, you run them through a model and you get the results, and the results are fairly staggering and very clear that there would be about 250,000 to 400,000 jobs lost annually because health costs would be higher for businesses and for individuals, that health insurance premiums would be about 9% higher than they otherwise would be, and that millions of people would be stuck in jobs that they don't really want, that it impairs a dynamic economy. They would not be able to retire, not be able to go part-time, take care of children or elderly parents, and would suffer lower wages as a result. So that's really what the study says. It's just trying to take what the economics community has been saying over the past 20 years and turn it into some numbers, and unfortunately, the nature of the numbers is pretty horrendous. But let me just stop there.
Congresswoman DeLauro?
Thank you. Thanks so much. It's great to be with you, and I really do relish the opportunity to be with you. And thank you, Neera, and Professor Cutler. I'm grateful to CAP as well for this very thoughtful and timely report that you all are engaged in. Professor Cutler, particularly thank you. This proves, once again, that repealing the Affordable Care Act, as House Republicans are threatening, would hurt jobs, it would hurt the middle class, and it would hurt the country. The findings the professor laid out, we're talking about adding almost $2,000 a year to family insurance premiums, destroying 250,000 to 400,000 jobs a year over the next decade. It's pretty staggering, especially when you take a look at what we're trying to get at in this climate. We have an obligation to get this economy on track again and to create jobs. And repealing health care reform moves us in the wrong direction. And the irony of it is that my colleagues on the other side of the aisle have the audacity to call health care reform, quote, job killing. We have the data that has been described here, as Professor Cutler shows, that the real job killer would be health care repeal. And mind you, that this paper comes out on the heels of yesterday's CBO report, which found that repeal would add $145 billion to the deficit through the end of the decade and $230 billion by 2021. So repeal kills jobs, causes premiums to rise, and adds billions to the deficit. It boggles the mind to think about how this could be considered a good idea. And yet, the Republicans tell us again and again they are committed to repeal. Instead of focusing on America's number one priority, creating jobs, they would rather slash and burn the law that provides quality, affordable health coverage to all Americans. Why are they engaged in this effort? Do they want to see big insurers discriminate against people with pre-existing conditions again? It's been pointed out the outset, I am an ovarian cancer survivor. I have a pre-existing condition. There aren't too many insurance companies or companies who want me as part of their workforce. I drive the cost of health care up. Or do we want to see insurers charge women more for the same coverage? Do we want young people under 26 to be kicked off of their parents' coverage? Do we want to get rid of the affordability credits for small businesses and for working families? It doesn't really make any sense. And yet the push is on for repeal because, quite frankly, it's what I believe is that what the insurance companies want. So we prove once again in the first week back here that my colleagues on the other side of the aisle are beholden to big donors, whether it's on Wall Street or in the insurance industry. What we need to do here is to have a positive agenda on how to get our economy growing again and putting Americans back to work. That's what our obligation is. What we've just seen in the past couple of days is a Republican Party that is trying to take a sledgehammer to the programs that middle-class families rely on. Being in a campaign mode is one set of circumstances. When you are in charge of governing, qu- quite simply, you have to be serious about the responsibility of governing. The issues that are before us, and particularly with regard to health care, which is a transformative piece of legislation, it will make an unbelievable difference in people's lives. It already is doing that. And you have to stop the campaigning, and you have got to start the governing. These problems are not partisan problems. They are serious challenges that face this country, and it is the obligation to not deal with what would uphold your political base, but rather what is going to be in the best interest of the country. And repealing health care is not in the best interest of the country. It doesn't protect jobs. It doesn't protect the middle class. It will create a worse deficit situation. Thank you very much for letting me participate.
Thank you so much, Congresswoman. And now we'd like to open it up for questions.
At this time, if you'd like to ask an audio question, you may do so by pressing star 1 on your telephone keypad. Again, that is star 1 to ask a question. We will pause for just a moment to compile the Q&A roster. Our first question comes from Julie Rovner from NPR.
Hi, thanks for taking my question. As I'm sure you're aware, the Republicans are painting this as the number one job killer. And I was wondering what evidence you have that that this law is not deterring job growth in the broader economy.
David, would you like to take that?
Sure. Of course, so far only a few things have gone into effect, and as the Congresswoman said, those things are very popular among people. They're the idea that you can't be thrown off your insurance coverage and children should be able to be covered, so on. And I think the reason why those are popular is in part because they interact with the economy, and people say, well, goodness, maybe I will be able to go to a new job finally without worrying about health care, and I won't feel so insecure about it. But obviously, many of the provisions go into effect later. If you look, though, at the studies that have been done when surveys have been asked of businesses, you know, in light of the reduction in premiums that you'd expect to see and the small business tax credit, what would you do? They get uniformly positive responses of the business community. So I think that a lot of the business community actually, they want to see it go into effect. They're actually quite eager to make it happen, to make the cost savings happen as soon as possible and not actually wait. And that as that happens, they will actually be responding quite favorably. But again, it's still the very, very early days of the actual things that will save them, that will save the most money.
You also are seeing that businesses are, there's a better sense that with right now being able to get one-third of the premium covered through a tax credit, that the ability to offer health insurance, small businesses are feeling better about the ability to do that, where they wouldn't be able to do it when they wouldn't be able to do it in the past.
Right. The small business majority put out, I think, research on Tuesday showing that small businesses that were taking up the tax credit were responding very positively and offering health insurance. And they believed it would expand their ability to offer health insurance, and it was helping their bottom line. And obviously, we've had private sector job growth over the last several months, and more was announced today.
I think one of the arguments that Republicans are making is that there's a lot of uncertainty among larger employers about how this law will affect them and affect premiums going forward, and that may be deterring them from doing more hiring that they might otherwise be doing.
And one response to that is the notion that having a year-long debate on repealing legislation that just passed is only going to further uncertainty, not go the other way.
So what would you say if you're talking about repealing? What is the replacement? What is the replacement? There is no information. There are no specifics. Nothing to talk about those pieces that are currently in place, which are already making a difference. Not by my view, but you just heard about small business, but you can, you know, you talk to parents about their recently graduated from college a son or daughter, and about the ability to stay on. Talk to parents of, you know, autistic kids who are going broke because they haven't been able to get any assistance with these, or asthma, or see, all regarded as pre-existing conditions.
Julie, the NFIB has been doing surveys of small businesses for about 25 years, asking them what their list of headaches were, what problems they have. Since 1986, the number one issue on their list consistently has been the cost of health insurance.
Absolutely.
And so the way we're going to help, one of the biggest ways we're going to help small business is by doing something on health insurance. Now, what we know is that the folks who this law benefits the most probably are the small businesses with the tax credits and the insurance exchanges and the purchasing power effects and the changes in the nature of how that they're not going to get dropped and that they don't have to become insurance brokers on their own and that all of that. So an enormous part of this is really designed to help ease the small business community. I would love it, just to come back to what the congresswoman said, I would love it if instead of having a debate on repeal, what we did was we said, let's figure out maybe there's even more. Maybe there are good ideas about even more we can do to help small businesses on health insurance. Let's get together and talk about all of those ideas. Let's build on what we have. Rather, you know, no one's going to say this is the perfect thing, but rather than saying, let's go three steps backwards, say, is there any way we can move things even more forward?
Good, thank you.
Next question.
And our next question comes from line of Byron Tao from Politico.
This is a question for Congresswoman DeLauro, and it's a political question. Do you have any concerns, or are there any concerns among progressives in the caucus about the implication of William Daley taking over as White House Chief of Staff regarding the future of health care? I mean, he's on the record calling it as an overreach. Are there any political implications to his selection?
I don't see any political implications to his selection. First of all, just personally, I know Bill Daley. When he was Secretary of Commerce, I know him. I think he will be an outstanding Chief of Staff of the President. I think the White House, the House and the Senate, the Democrats in the House and the Senate, and clearly the President of the United States would veto a repeal of health care. And quite frankly, Secretary Sebelius has been traveling about and talking about what repeal would mean and what the cost of a repeal would mean as well. So I think that Bill Daley will serve the president well as the chief of staff.
Can we go to the next question?
Yes, our next question comes from the line of Robert Pear from the New York Times.
Thank you. I have a rather crude question for the professor. If you look at employment numbers over the years, healthcare sector has been one of the bright spots, and often adding jobs when other sectors haven't. If the law is successful or effective in reducing the growth of health spending, might that lead to fewer healthcare jobs, and is that necessarily a bad thing?
Thank you for the question, Robert. I don't know that it's necessarily crude, but it's a very good one. I think over time, we may see some reduction in, particularly in the growth of employment, not necessarily in the level of employment, but particularly in the growth of employment. Now, where I think we would potentially see some of those, or what I should say differently, what I think is what we would really see is a shift from the non-clinical aspects of medical care into more of the clinical aspects. So, for example, The 10 to 15% of medical spending on administrative costs involves a lot of people. And if we can do things that would reduce those administrative costs, that would free up some of those resources. Now, it turns out a fair amount of those resources are in people who are nurses and nurse assistants, but who are really doing clinical jobs. What it will do is it will free up those resources to do other things. The most obvious other thing that it will free up people to do is provide more primary care and preventive care. So we know we want people to have that, and there's a big problem in that we don't have the people who are on the ground now with the free time now. And so the way that I think this will play out is a shift from the aspects which are kind of chasing paper and dealing with a system that's completely unworkable into one that says, let's deal more with prevention, let's deal more with chronic care, let's deal more with people when they're coming out of the hospital and need help. And, oh, by the way, we have all these people who have been doing nothing but billing, but are trained for other things. Let's move them into that. So I suspect that will be the biggest shift that we'll see.
Professor, let me add on. It's a great question, Robert, but what about the emphasis in the bill on community care, community health care, and professors and primary care in that regard? Does that fit into what you're talking about, Professor, is a shift to what the nature of health delivery?
Yes, thank you for bringing that up, because I should have done it, and that's exactly right. There are other aspects associated with more community prevention, for example, the kinds of examples we have going on in North Carolina and other parts of the country, where the community prevention efforts really seem to be very successful. And, of course, what they are is they're starved. They're starved for money, they're starved for people, they're starved for talent. And again, as you free up resources, I think that's where some of those resources are going to go, is into kind of direct care and helping set up the community mechanisms that are going to help people, instead of just into the billing and other administrative ends.
And also, there are resources in the legislation directly to help attract more primary care doctors and to actually invest in the creation of jobs in those arenas as well. So that's an area where we'll be actually creating jobs more directly through the legislation.
Let me add one more thing, because when I was at the outset of talking about healthcare, I went to in New Haven to Quinnipiac University, and where they have a very, very fulsome program in training healthcare professionals at, you know, not to say lower levels, but of, you know, their healthcare professionals, nurses, nurse practitioners, the whole range of people. And it's healthcare professionals, but it is the important training aspects of that, where you've got very competent healthcare professionals dealing at a local level.
Let me just, Robert, there was one fact that was in my mind that I realized I should say. There are people who have done these kind of time and motion studies of nurses in a hospital, very highly trained, very dedicated, enormously dedicated people. And they sort of follow them with a stopwatch all day, and they observe what they do. The single most common thing that a nurse with 18 years of education does in her day is document things. And that's a third of her day. And another 10% of her time is spent running around the hospital chasing supplies that are not where they're supposed to be by these sort of stopwatch measures. So basically 45% of the 2 million hospital-based nurses, 45% of that time, or roughly a million nurses a year, is spent doing administrative and clerical tasks that we absolutely don't need to do. That's a million people we can devote to primary care, community-based care, preventive care, chronic disease management, transitional care. That's the nature of the job shift that we're going to see. A million nurses a year.
And we have time for one more question.
Our next question is from Deidre Shingreen from Connecticut Mirror.
Hi, thanks for taking my question. I wanted to ask Congresswoman DeLauro to follow up a little bit on what you said about the Republicans' motivation being that this is what the insurance industry wants. I mean, can you just elaborate on that? And specifically, I mean, there are a lot of insurance companies in Connecticut, obviously. What are you hearing from them about the repeal efforts? Because my sense was it's maybe a little more complicated than that they want full repeal.
Well, it may be more complicated, but I think we saw in Connecticut is probably one of the most egregious examples of the rate increase was it, and there was one just been asked for in California, but in Connecticut, and this was several months ago. I mean, it was actually just right before the election, quite frankly, where they called for a 40% increase in premiums. And at that time, there was a health insurance commissioner in Connecticut who just allowed it to happen without any public hearings, without any effort. And quite frankly, a number of us, challenged that because the bill actually provided, and HHS provided $1 million to the state in order to have a review process to see why what would be the reason for an increase. None of that funding, there was no review process in essence. Long and the short of that, I'll cut, right at the end of the story, is that, first of all, the insurance commissioner resigned. Secondly, the increase was denied, and because there had been there was a public hearing, then they were forced to have a public hearing, and then the increase was denied. I don't think it may be complicated, and it may be not as blatant as saying that we want to repeal, but I believe that they're finding ways in which they are going to try to escalate costs and try to blame that on the new bill. The other piece of this was that the company Anthem had a year ago, when there was no health care bill, asked for an increase as well. But they found that it was convenient to place the blame on the newly signed health care bill.
Well, I was just wondering, as a follow-up, have you talked specifically to folks at Cigna and Aetna about the repeal effort and any changes that they would support or would oppose?
Well, this repeal effort just started here within the last couple of days, so no, I haven't. I'd also say I said two things. I believe that some of this is founded on insurance companies, wanting to make it as difficult as possible to move forward. And secondly, I think there is, heaven forfend that one would say this, but I think it's the politics of shoring up a political base that a lot of the repeal is attached to, because it still is not going to be repealed.
Thank you all very much. We appreciate your questions. And if you have follow-up, you can reach out to us here at the center. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. This concludes today's